Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segreto, and this is Franchise Today. Today, I'll be joined by Dylan Tracy, attorney and partner at Wiley Ryan, which Washingtonian magazine has called one of the country's most respected law firms. Always get Washingtonian. I always mispronounce it. I'm sorry. Anyway, Dylan and I will explore the world of bankruptcy from both the franchisee and franchisor perspective and discuss how bankruptcy affects all parties to the franchise agreement. Last week, as most of our listeners know, my guest was franchise attorney and partner at Nixon Peabody, Arthur Pressman. Arthur and I discussed franchise litigation and specifically the events leading up to franchise litigation and the necessary steps franchisors must take to minimize the possibility of litigation. By virtue of the high number of listeners that accessed the show on demand over the weekend, I would have to say it was one of our more popular shows. But when you really look at the weekly increases in listenership on Franchise Today since early 2010, someone would be very hard-pressed not to refer to Franchise Today as an overwhelming success. To that end, I have to again thank Franchise Today co-producer Joe Caruso for a remarkable job in lining up the best of the best in franchising week after week. My job certainly becomes easier when I'm having a conversation with the brightest minds in franchising. Thanks again, Joe, for making me look better. And in case you've missed a show or would just like listening to a particular segment more than one time, all Franchise Today segments are available on demand at www.blogtalkradio.com/Franchise Today Show. As many within the franchise community are aware, a couple of months ago we introduced a new component of Franchise Essentials Media Group, and that was called and is called Franchise News Radio. Well, I'm pleased to announce that Franchise News Radio is starting to show signs of gaining some traction in the franchise world as listenership numbers gradually increase from week to week. You know, considering that it's summer and we expected low numbers until at least September when everyone had, the summer days and vacation behind them, we're certainly excited by the numbers and the progression that we're seeing, and we want to thank everybody. So thanks to all who listen in every Wednesday morning at 7 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Eastern Time to Franchise News Radio. And if you've missed a segment or two or just learning of this weekly show, may I recommend you listen on demand at www.blogtalkradio.com/Franchise News Radio. And by the way, if you have any news, blog articles, or press releases to share with the franchise community, please be sure to send me the information, and I'll be certain to include it in the next segment of Franchise News Radio. And my email address is paulsegreto@franchisenewsradio.com. You know, yesterday on Franchise News Radio, I shared a recent press release from the International Franchise Association, and I feel compelled to do it again. So here goes. The International Franchise Association urged the Senate to reject a bill that threatens the First Amendment rights of small business owners who wish to engage in the policy-setting process. IFA President, Vice President of Government Relations David French said in a letter to all senators, IFA strongly opposes S.3628, the Democracy is Strengthened by Casting Light on Spending in Elections Act, also known as Disclose. This legislation directly threatens the First Amendment rights of hundreds of thousands of small franchise business owners by placing onerous restrictions on the free speech of small businesses, corporations, and trade associations, while ignoring the political influence and spending of labor unions. The legislation would require significant new reporting requirements for corporations or trade associations that engage in various forms of express advocacy as well as issue-based voter education campaigns. French went on to say, the sponsors of the bill admit that the bill's purpose is to deter businesses and trade associations from participating in the political process. Small franchise businesses would be at a tremendous disadvantage since they do not have the resources that larger corporations or labor unions enjoy, so they often coalesce together through trade associations to amplify their voice. The Supreme Court has repeatedly recognized that voluntary associations are vital participants in our public debate and that government attempts to curb participation in associations to stifle their voice, which violates the First Amendment. French noted that the legislation imposes no comparable restrictions on labor unions, even though unions and their political action committees are the single largest contributor to political campaigns, and claim to have spent nearly $450 million in the 2008 presidential race alone. French ended his comments by saying the discriminatory treatment of corporations and small businesses is a significant departure from prior campaign finance legislation such as McCain-Feingold, in which Congress treated corporations and unions equally under the law, attempting to silence the voice of small businesses in the political process while enabling unions to retain their enormous influence is an unconstitutional threat to the election process. Very well said, David, and very well said, IFA. And speaking of the IFA, the next IFA Wednesday Wise webinar, which will feature Elements Local CEO Jeremy LeDuc and myself, in a presentation on using social media to market and build a strong online presence. Join the session, which is scheduled for August 4th at 2 p.m. Central, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And we'll be sure to set aside time within the one-hour session for some questions and answers. And the Wednesday Wise webinars are approved for 50 CFE participation credits each. So, enroll now to begin earning credits towards certified franchise executive designation, and the webinar is a great place to start if you haven't already started working towards your CFE. Now, today my guest is Dylan Tracy, business bankruptcy attorney and partner at the Washington, D.C. law firm of Wiley Ryan. He received his law degree from the George Washington University Law School and has been practicing corporate restructuring and bankruptcy for approximately 10 years. He is board certified in business bankruptcy law by the American Board of Certification. His practice includes representation of both businesses in need of restructuring as well as creditors of the distressed enterprise in bankruptcy cases and other litigation in courts throughout the United States. Dylan has represented both franchisors and franchisees in bankruptcy cases and receivership actions. And Dylan was recently recognized in the Legal 500 U.S. as a leading corporate restructuring attorney. Dylan, it's an honor to have you as my guest, and welcome to Franchise Today.
Thank you, Paul. It's great to be here, and good afternoon to everybody.
Well, you know, getting right down to it, I mean, bankruptcy is this abyss, this black hole that many in franchising want to circumvent. They look over the side, certainly not getting too close to fall in. It's certain that to most that they don't want to be in it. Franchisees certainly feel the same way, although it might not be as close on the radar as it is for franchisors, meaning just the concept of bankruptcy, as franchisors are dealing with multiple franchisees. And so, you know, looking at this black hole and that everybody wants to walk around and not even come close, and some want to even say it doesn't exist, and they feel by throwing leaves over it that hole doesn't exist. Well, of course, we know what happens if somebody covers a hole in the ground with leaves. Somebody's going to fall in unexpectedly, surprised, and, of course, get drastically hurt. So today we're hoping to attempt at least to demystify franchisor and franchisee bankruptcy and franchise bankruptcy in general. So, Dylan, I mean, as you know, bankruptcy seems to be one of the least understood areas of the law, even for, you know, astute business people, and I know, and you know, even some attorneys. Why does this seem to be all this confusion?
Well, there are a few reasons. I think that the primary reason, perhaps, is one that you just touched on, and that, you know, business people don't generally want to think about bankruptcy. It's not something that you want to have in your world. Unfortunately, whether your business itself is running into problems or a trade partner is running into problems, it's something that most business people will have to deal with over the course of their careers. You know, bankruptcy is complex in some respects, and it is riddled with technicalities. The bankruptcy code and rules are very lengthy and not always as straightforward as we'd like them to be. But, you know, the general purpose of bankruptcy law is to provide a framework to preserve value and an opportunity for businesses to have a fresh start and to equitably distribute value to our creditors, and, you know, prevent the race to the courthouse and scramble for assets that you would otherwise have in the absence of a structured proceeding like a bankruptcy case.
And I think the key word there is definitely structured, and certainly if anyone even has a remote chance of bankruptcy being on their radar, certainly I would recommend, as I know definitely that you would, that they hightail it right to their attorney, and certainly don't try to enter that world by themselves.
That's right. And you know, whether you're a creditor who is owed money from an entity that goes into bankruptcy, or, you know, you're wondering whether your business has a problem that's going to result in a trip to the bankruptcy court, the most common mistake I see is that people come to us too late. And, you know, it's unfortunate because the longer one waits, the more opportunities that can pass, and it's always better to think about seeing your attorney sooner rather than later.
Oh, absolutely. And I believe, just like I do in any business strategy, and certainly that would be considered a business strategy, is to start looking at your exit strategy from bankruptcy. What is it going to look like if you emerge from bankruptcy? Well, you know, I couldn't imagine going into Barnes & Noble, picking up a book, thumbing through the book, and finding chapters missing. And, you know, looking at bankruptcy, you know, I see the different chapters. I found, you know, chapters 7, 9, 11, 12, 13, and 15. What happened to 1 through 6, 8, 10, and 14? And I guess really take the humor aside, and more importantly, maybe you could explain the purpose and use of the various chapters available under the bankruptcy code.
Sure. Well, 1, 3, and 5 are in there. They just aren't their own chapter, but they're generally applicable to all cases. The ones that are missing, I have no idea why they are missing, but I suppose there's always room to add additional chapters. You hear Congress talking about, oh, well, perhaps we need a new chapter of the bankruptcy code for entities that are, quote, too big to fail. But the ones we currently have start with Chapter 7. That's for businesses and individuals, which is liquidation, and that's a chapter where immediately on the filing, a Chapter 7 trustee is appointed to take over, in the case of a business, either the operations, and he usually shuts those down immediately, or in the case of an individual, all of the individual's non-exempt assets, and the trustee then simply proceeds to sell those assets that he can and distribute the proceeds in accordance with the priorities which are set forth in Chapter 5 of the Bankruptcy Code. The trustee is then paid a commission at the end of the case for his efforts based on the amount of money that he distributes. Chapter 9 is for cities and counties. It's called municipal debt adjustment. It's perhaps the least common form of bankruptcy, but as we hear news reports, it may get more use. To be clear, states are not eligible for Chapter 9 bankruptcy.
Okay.
Yeah, everybody's familiar, I think, with Chapter 11. That's the reorganization section of the bankruptcy code, primarily used for corporations, although in some instances individuals with many assets can file Chapter 11. In a Chapter 11 case, the management continues to run the business unless the bankruptcy court decides that they're unfit and appoints a trustee. The goal, of course, in a Chapter 11 case is to propose and confirm a reorganization plan to restructure the business or sell the business as a going concern. And to that end, it's sort of interesting. Many Chapter 11 cases are actually orderly liquidations, and there is some confusion as to what, you know, when someone says a business has gone into Chapter 7. Sometimes it's actually still in Chapter 11, but they've just decided to do an orderly liquidation under Chapter 11. Chapter 12 is farmers and family fishermen debt adjustment. I honestly don't have any experience with respect to that chapter. We don't have too many farmers in the Washington, D.C. area.
Well, I imagine, though, the fisherman one might come into play in light of this BP oil crisis.
Well, that's a good point. You know, skipping over a chapter, the other one that might come into play is Chapter 15, and that's cross-border cases. Now, everybody's up in arms about BP perhaps filing for bankruptcy, but, you know, they if they did that, it's more than likely that they might file in London. And, you know, that could be a headache for a lot of people, and Chapter 15 of the Bankruptcy Code would come into play if that were to occur. Finally, Chapter 13 is debt adjustment for individuals. That's where the individual goes into bankruptcy, and sometimes you have a sole proprietorship or some other business that's really a doing business as, but it's where they have a five-year plan to pay off the debts that they can pay, and it's overseen by the bankruptcy court. So that's really the general overview of the applicable types of bankruptcy that are currently in the bankruptcy code.
Now, as you were speaking, and I was thinking about a couple of different things about, you know, misconceptions and myths that people, you know, have heard and stuff. And two things in particular come into mind. Number one, when you're talking about Chapter 11, and like you made a good point, you know, a lot of people think that bankruptcy is the end all, and a lot of times in Chapter 11 it's to reorganize or position the company to be purchased. But I also think a myth there is that people think you can only file for bankruptcy once, and yet I know Continental Airlines had gone into Chapter 11 multiple times. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, we call them Chapter 22s. When a company goes into Chapter 11, confirms a reorganization plan, and finds itself back in bankruptcy several years later, sometimes really not that long after the first bankruptcy. Two cases that come to mind that were filed in my area of the country are U.S. Airways and Movie Gallery. Both of them were bankruptcy plans that got confirmed, and they found themselves back in, you know, only a few years later. And so that does happen. And, you know, part of the bankruptcy code is really about that opportunity to preserve the business enterprise and the value that's associated there. Sometimes, you know, the plans that get confirmed by judges don't work. You know, nobody's perfect, and sometimes the business plan doesn't work, but you know, that doesn't mean you can't try again.
Right.
You know, the judge is most likely going to give you a shorter leash the second time around.
Sure. I guess us golfers call that a mulligan, right?
Right. Well, yeah, I think that it could be similar, but, you know, I think the stakes are generally higher in the in the bankruptcy world, unless you're Tiger Woods.
Right. And that's a whole nother topic for a whole nother show.
Right.
You know, another thing, you know, talking about myths and misconceptions, as you mentioned, the BP situation. It's my understanding, and maybe this is just my own personal misconception, so help me here on this. There's also a pending, or maybe not pending, maybe it's just discussion right now, that there might be some criminal charges with respect to BP. And certainly, well, maybe not certainly, again, maybe this is my misconception. Is it true that with respect to criminal stuff, I mean, that doesn't fall under the same protection as bankruptcy? I mean, if their acts were criminal that caused the loss and eventually led to the loss, then obviously that really muddies the waters, and maybe that's maybe not the right word considering we're talking about the waters of the Gulf.
Right, no, but you're correct. I think it's important that the primary reason that bankruptcy is beneficial is that it affords a company what's known as the automatic stay, and that is an injunction against basically all legal proceedings against the entity that files for bankruptcy, with a few exceptions, and one of them is police and regulatory actions. So, you know, a bankruptcy filed, a Chapter 11 bankruptcy filed in the United States by BP or its North American affiliate, probably wouldn't get them out of the water in terms of the criminal proceedings. Now, you know, I mentioned earlier that if they filed in London and attempted to employ English bankruptcy law there, I don't know whether those proceedings would be stopped. But under Chapter 11 in the United States, it would not be.
Well, all those aside, are there other common myths and misconceptions that people have about bankruptcy?
Well, you know, again, I think that the myth that we've talked about a little bit is that bankruptcy is failure. And certainly, you know, if your business, everything went as planned, you wouldn't wind up in bankruptcy court. But, you know, again, I think bankruptcy is really about opportunity and, you know, a chance for a breathing spell and a fresh start.
So when should business owners and executive management, you know, actually start looking at Chapter 11 bankruptcy to reorganize a business? And of course, you know, is there a appropriate time? And also on the other side of it, when is it inappropriate?
Well, you know, certainly you don't need to come in to see a bankruptcy lawyer if you've missed, you know, one or two payments to a vendor and you know, you're able to catch those up. But, you know, most business people that I've talked to sort of, and I get this too, you know, you sort of, you know, feel like, well, something might be happening here. We might be in trouble. And it's, you know, there's a lot of factors that can go into that. You could be concerned about your financial projections going forward. You could have expanded too quickly. But as I said before, the worst thing that somebody can do is wait too long. So if you have any inkling that, look, we're in trouble here, we might not make our loan covenants, we're going to have to start getting behind, we're not going to pay our franchisor, can't make the ad fund contributions, you know, once that starts to become a real possibility, that's when you need to go in and see your bankruptcy lawyer. And as I said, it you can't do it too soon. I mean, the worst that's going to happen is if you're going to sit down and you're going to have to pay a couple hours worth of legal fees for him to say, well, I think you're okay for now. Let's revisit this in 3 or 4 months. But that's money that's well spent, because it can save a lot of time and effort down the road if you had to file. The worst thing in the world is an emergency filing. You know, Enron's a prime example of that. I think they got that together in about a week, and you know, it's just not practical for a case of that size. You need some planning.
Right. Absolutely. And certainly, at the first inkling, someone should run to their attorney because sticking their head in the sand, as I always say, sticks your biggest asset up in the air for everybody to see and take advantage of, and that's not a very pretty picture.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's not one of those things that you can always measure, but I think a lot of people sort of get that feeling down in the pit of their stomach that, well, you know, it's a little bit uneasy right now. You know, it's not, the world's not coming to an end, but I just don't like how this is going.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes that's the best time to come and see your bankruptcy lawyer.
Now, do most Chapter 7 bankruptcy liquidations actually start out as Chapter 11 reorganizations?
I don't know if it's most. A lot certainly do. You often have conversions to Chapter 7. And particularly these days, in 2005, there were amendments to the bankruptcy code that made it a lot more difficult to confirm either a reorganization plan or even a plan of liquidation under Chapter 11. So what you see a lot of these days is Chapter 11 cases that sell the business as a going concern in Chapter 11, and then the case is converted to Chapter 7 to administer the remaining assets, and that's become very common, particularly since the 2005 amendments.
Right, and I know on the franchise front, Luby's just purchased Fuddruckers out of bankruptcy, and then of course, you know, looking at a larger franchise, I know the Texas Rangers are in the middle of a bankruptcy, and of course, they're going through the trials and tribulations of people coming up wanting to buy it and waiting for judges' approval, and then of course the creditors are throwing a wrench into it, and so it does become complicated and expensive. I mean, a lot of people I know that look at, or they're in a position, you know, say, I'm just going to walk away because I can't even afford to file for bankruptcy. I mean, is that a misconception, or is that a reality?
Well, there is a reality that filing for a Chapter 11 reorganization can be expensive. And part of the problem is it's difficult to predict how expensive it will be. There are a lot of bankruptcies that are fairly reasonably priced in terms of the assets and the debt that's adjusted versus the amount of attorney's fees. But, you know, oftentimes that occurs when there's a deal in place to go through an orderly bankruptcy with, you know, perhaps a sale already set up as a stalking horse, or even a prearranged bankruptcy where the debt's going to take out the equity, and you're going to do a debt for equity swap, and you know, those can be fairly reasonable, but it can get very expensive if you have a franchisee and a franchisor who are in a big battle, and there's difficulty working with each other and a lack of trust. That's when the attorney's fees start to rise, and you know, those are the type of situations that are best avoided, but sometimes they're just inevitable.
Sure, and of course when the filing party, whether it be a franchisor or a franchisee in the franchise world, actually in bankruptcy, providing their attorney with the correct information, and of course it's got to be expensive every time they come out of the woodwork and say, oh, I forgot about this. Oh, yeah, that's right. We had this and we made that transaction. I mean, certainly the attorney having to go back, I guess partly to the drawing board, obviously adds up in legal fees. So I guess some advice to anybody entertaining bankruptcy is make sure you're prepared and make sure you have accurate information.
That's definitely true. To be fair, it's very difficult to get all of the forms right on the first go. And as I said before, you know, there are so many technicalities involved that, you know, a lot of times we see something that you understand why the business person didn't let you know, because, well, it's only important in the scheme of things because of some, you know, specific bankruptcy rule that you know, that nobody would know about except for the bankruptcy lawyer. And so, you know, oftentimes the business people omit things, and, you know, while we certainly don't advise them to do that, I sometimes understand why they do.
Sure. Well, let's look at a situation, a hypothetical situation. You know, a franchisor receives notice that one of its multi-unit franchisees has filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and this franchisee owes royalties, ad fund contributions to the franchisor, as well as maybe significant sums of money to key suppliers. What's a franchisor to do at that point? I mean, what's the first step they need to take?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I think in that situation, they've probably already missed the first step, because it really shouldn't come as a surprise. You know, if somebody is getting behind on their ad funds and their royalties, I think that franchisors should have internal controls in place to, you know, to try and monitor that, and when a situation such as a bankruptcy does occur, hopefully there's been a conversation with the company ahead of time. Now, if that hasn't happened, I think the first thing you do is you have to understand what the bankruptcy filing means, and I mentioned the automatic stay a few minutes ago. But what that automatic stay means is that you can't send any more termination letters. You can't institute legal proceedings, and if you do, you're in violation. And sometimes not everybody understands that. Perhaps the legal, the general counsel knows that at the franchisor's office, but not everybody who sends out the notices does. So it's important to have internal controls in place so that, you know, once a bankruptcy happens, it's sort of like a line in the sand. Your pre-petition debts are subject to the bankruptcy, and you can't seek to collect those, but the post-petition debts are supposed to be paid in the ordinary course of business by the Chapter 11 debtor. And so it's important to make sure that there's one or two individuals that are sort of in control of the franchisor's response to the bankruptcy, whether that's the general counsel or assistant general counsel. You know, you're going to get a lot of paperwork at the beginning of a bankruptcy case, and that's really the most important thing to do, is to understand the ramifications of the bankruptcy and what the debtor is really trying to do with the bankruptcy.
Good point. You know, you mentioned a lot about, you know, going to counsel and, you know, from a franchisor's position, but, you know, you have a lot of startup franchisors, emerging franchisors that don't have in-house counsel, have outside counsel, and they know in their mind that, you know, legal fees can mount. And how strong is your recommendation that a franchisor that receives notice of a bankruptcy filing by a franchisee, how strong is your recommendation that the franchisor immediately go to their own attorney to handle in this, as opposed to trying to handle some of this on their own?
Well, it's pretty strong. Now, you know, if a franchisee files bankruptcy and you know, you're owed a couple of grand in ad funds and royalties, and, you know, then maybe you can wait a little bit. But at the same time, it's important for the franchisor, even in smaller cases, to protect their rights and their brand with respect to the franchise agreement. Make sure that the franchisee is not attempting to use the bankruptcy process to make an end run out of some of the restrictions in the franchise agreement. And you know, that's really the heart of any franchisee bankruptcy case, is, you know, what's going to happen with the franchise agreement.
Well, in a Chapter 11, what would actually happen to the franchise agreement?
Well, the franchise agreement is considered an executory contract. And what that means is it's a contract that has, you know, obligations that are owed by each side. And the bankruptcy code provides an opportunity for, with respect to most contracts, the assumption and assignment of that contract to a third party.
Mm-hmm.
However, franchise agreements have sort of special rights because they also typically include trademark and copyright licenses. And so while under a normal bankruptcy circumstance, a contract could be assumed and assigned without regard to any contractual language to the contrary. I know a lot of contracts, both inside franchising and generally, say, look, this contract can't be assigned without the consent of the counterparty. That's not enforceable in bankruptcy.
Well, you know, I've certainly seen my share of franchise agreements, and have assisted from a practical standpoint in forming some of them. But I've seen terminology in franchise agreements that say a reason for termination of the franchise agreement is the voluntary or involuntary filing of a bankruptcy petition by the franchisee, and it seems like a contradiction because there is an automatic stay. Can you clear the air on that one?
Sure. That terminology, the default on bankruptcy or the termination on bankruptcy language, is what we refer to as an ipso facto clause, that you're terminated by virtue of the bankruptcy filing itself. Those clauses are not enforceable in a bankruptcy context and are disregarded as a matter of course by bankruptcy judges. And that's why, you know, I wanted to explain a little bit about the copyright and trademark aspect of the franchise agreement, which really gives the franchisor a big hook. And that's because the section that I just explained about assumption and assignment and the unenforceability of ipso facto clause also contains a section that says, unless other applicable law would prevent that assignment.
Ah, I see.
And under both copyright and trademark law, there is a general prohibition on the assignment without the consent of the licensor, in this case the franchisor. To make matters, depending on which side of the fence you sit, better or worse, there is specific language in the bankruptcy code that seems to say that you can't even assume the contract if you could not then assign it. And so in some cases, the bankruptcy can be dead in the water if the franchisor is really set on controlling the case and not working with the present management. Now, in my experience, the franchisor usually does want to work with the current management and get the business up and running. But there have been cases where there are bad acts on the part of management or other reasons why the franchisor wants to stick to its guns and make every effort to control the outcome of the case.
Right. You know, you brought up a good phrase a little bit earlier when you mentioned the line in the sand. What happens when a franchisor crosses over that line in the sand? I mean, you know, emotions fly high and they owe money. I've got to protect the system. And they jump over that line. What are the potential repercussions for crossing that line and ignoring that that automatic stay?
Well, if a company willfully violates the automatic stay by attempting to collect a debt outside of the bankruptcy process itself, the bankruptcy court is empowered to entertain sanctions you know, depending on what the action is, an action that violates the automatic stay is typically void or voidable at the option of the debtor. So it really doesn't make any sense at all for someone who's owed money in a bankruptcy case to try and employ processes outside the bankruptcy to collect the debt.
Right. What so let's go to the other side of the coin. We talked about, you know, the franchisor receiving notice of a multi-unit franchisee filing a bankruptcy petition. What should a franchisee do if they find out that their franchisor has filed for bankruptcy?
Well, the first thing they should do is to review the bankruptcy filings and figure out what the plan is. Is this a situation where they have a buyer who's going to keep in place the franchises, or at least the majority of the franchises, and you know, hopefully that's the case. If you're the franchisee, hopefully there's a real good plan in place. It's not an emergency filing. They have a deal either to do a debt for equity swap or as I said, sell the business. It's also important to note that the obligations under the franchise agreement, including the payment of royalties and ad funds, continue to run. The fact that the franchisor has filed for bankruptcy does not mean that you don't owe that money to the bankrupt entity. It's important to keep everything current, and you know, the franchisor has the opportunity to hopefully assume that contract. You hope that they assume your franchise agreement. It is possible that they could seek a rejection, and in which case you could fight that out in the bankruptcy court. But it's really important that the franchisee continue to operate its business to the best of its ability as usual.
Right. But, you know, we've heard stories time after time as franchisors filing for bankruptcy, and of course, franchisees immediately think, oh, there's not going to be a system. What's going to happen to the brand? I'm going to be out here by myself, especially if they're in a remote location where they are geographically remote and isolated. And you hear a lot about, well, I'm going to stop paying my royalties, I'm going to stop paying it. What are the, and I understand the obligations from the franchise agreement, what you said, but what are the potential repercussions if they decide to stop paying royalties?
Well, in that case, I mean, it's really the same as it would be out of bankruptcy. The franchisor is likely to initiate an action, and it's probably going to be filed in the bankruptcy case, which is almost certainly going to be in New York or Delaware, enter a judgment against the franchisee. And, you know, it also makes it more likely that, you know, you're going to be one of those franchisees that is on the list of rejected contracts. And I don't think that's where most would want to be. The businesses
right.
aren't really dependent in most instances on the franchise system.
And then they'll most likely be in front of a federal judge as opposed to a local judge.
That's right. And you know, the filing of a bankruptcy is just not a reason to stop paying under the franchise agreement. And, you know, that said, it's important for the franchisor who goes into bankruptcy to have a communications plan in place, and we say this with all of our debtor clients. It's not just franchise that this is applicable to, but they really need to have a plan in place to inform the franchisees, their employees, and everybody who does business with them what exactly the plan is, and to provide some comfort with respect to what's going to happen in the future.
Sure, absolutely. Communications is always paramount and always essential.
And along those lines, I mean, a franchisor may, you know, may be able to take some steps in the bankruptcy case to ensure that its critical functions to the franchisees are going to remain in place. There's, you know, if the franchisor itself is a supplier, which we have seen in some cases, mostly the oil change company. Sometimes you have a franchisor that's also a supplier of goods. Of course, it gets goods as well, and it's important that those vendors be taken care of either through the 503b9 claim process, which affords a special priority to suppliers, or through a critical vendor motion.
You know, I know having worked with a franchisor that was in Chapter 11 bankruptcy, some of the franchisees, you know, put money in escrow for royalties, and then, of course, when they got a notice from the court, they immediately paid them. But I remember one franchisee in particular that immediately stopped paying the royalties and evidently had not put it into escrow. And when he was politely requested by the court to remit his royalties, he didn't have the money. And I remember, and this is back in 1989, I believe, 89 or 90. And I don't know how much has changed since then, but I'll tell you one thing. It was an uncomfortable position for him to be standing in front of that bankruptcy judge explaining that he decided not to pay the royalties and didn't have the money to pay his royalties.
Right. Well, that's a good way to for the franchisee to end up in bankruptcy. It's in addition to the amount of royalties that's owed, it's possible that the bankruptcy judge, depending on the language of the franchise agreement, might order payment of attorney's fees or other penalties.
Sure. So let's say a franchisor goes into Chapter 7 and there's a liquidation of assets and payment to creditors. What happens to the franchise agreements?
Well, similar to a Chapter 11, the franchise agreements have to either be assumed or rejected. However, in the Chapter 7, any contract that's not expressly assumed within 60 days of the bankruptcy filing or the conversion to Chapter 7 is deemed rejected, subject to an ability of the trustee to seek an extension of of that deadline from the bankruptcy court. So you're really on a tighter string, and you know, if the bankruptcy case is in Chapter 7 and the trustee does not assume or reject the franchise agreement or get an extension of time, it's going to be rejected. And you know, there have been some cases I know where franchisees have come together and attempted to purchase the assets that give rise to the franchise or their own franchise agreement, so that they can keep using the brands, keep using the franchise system, because that's important to the franchisees.
Sure, absolutely. And I know there have been some bankruptcy cases in franchising, some obviously more on everybody's radar than others. What have been some of the more interesting bankruptcy cases in franchising that, you know, you might be able to talk about? Obviously, I know there's some attorney-client privilege. Is there any that you can talk about, or just even in generalities?
Well, I can talk about a few in general. I think I had mentioned the a case where we represented a franchisor that was in the oil change business, and the franchisee went into bankruptcy. And in that case, there was both a franchise agreement and a supply agreement that were separate. The franchisee attempted to assume the franchise agreement but reject the supply agreement. His business rationale was that he felt he could buy his oil cheaper at Walmart, you know, regardless of whether it was the right brand or not. And that was set up for a really big fight, because I'm sure you can imagine the franchisor was not about to let that happen if you know, he could stop it at all. Ultimately, you know, the case settled before before it went to trial. But that's the type of situation that a bankruptcy case can cause, where you have two distinct contracts and you know, attempt to keep one and reject the other. You know, another case was a fast food case in Ohio where, representing the franchisor, the secured lender was underwater by a tremendous amount, and as is the franchisor's right, we demanded a full cure of our defaults in order to assume the franchise agreement. And that's actually something that's very important that I don't think we mentioned, but in order to assume the franchise agreement, the franchisee has to cure all the monetary defaults. So, you know, if you're owed $100,000 for pre-petition royalties, those have to be paid before that franchise agreement can get assumed.
Right.
The in that case, the secured lender wanted us to take a haircut, and we wouldn't do it. A couple of units went for sale in terms of auctioning the actual, you know, fryers and you know, hard assets of the restaurant. And we got into a bidding war with the secured lender who was just trying to take them out of spite so that we couldn't use the equipment. But you know, it ultimately ended up being a Pyrrhic victory for the secured creditor when they paid, you know, essentially retail price for 5-year-old equipment.
Well, certainly emotions can run high in that situation, and but hopefully reasonable minds prevail. You know, I know, you know, a lot of people cringe at the word of bankruptcy. We talked about misconceptions. We talked about myths. And I think you'd agree there's a social stigma with bankruptcy. I mean, in your opinion, probably seeing the worst of the worst, I mean, do you think bankruptcy is a true, legitimate business tool?
Well, it is, but it's the last tool. I mean, it's the tool you only play if that's the only option. It's much better to work out the disputes and any arrearages with your creditors outside the bankruptcy process. And you know, but at the end of the day, you know, sometimes there's just not enough money to go around, or people won't agree to take haircuts, and it's the only option. Sometimes, you know, something happens that's a surprise that nobody could have foreseen, and you know, bankruptcy is the only way to get a breathing spell, or you know, and to stop that race to the courthouse. So I do think it's a legitimate business tool, but there's a substantial stigma such that it's the last resort.
Right. Absolutely. And I agree, looking at it from a practical standpoint, obviously not the legal standpoint, and I agree with what you're saying, that it should be the last tool, and obviously communications and planning and everything else should preempt all of it. Why is but there are some naysayers out there that say, you know, bankruptcy is too easy. It allows people and businesses the opportunity to renege on their obligations, etc. Why should we be happy that the U.S. bankruptcy code is there for us? Why is it important to the economy? And you know, shed some light on that and help, you know, kind of settle down some of the naysayers.
Well, it's because it provides structure to a process that allows the preservation of value. And, you know, you look at some cases, and in preparing for today, I went back and looked at some of the franchise cases that have happened recently. And, you know, you take a case like Pizzeria Uno, for example, and in that case, it doesn't look like the unsecured creditors are going to receive much of, if anything. But at the same time, the bankruptcy process has allowed that brand to continue, has allowed the preservation of jobs. And, you know, in the absence of that process, you look at a lot of companies and, you know, what do they have other than their brand that is of value? If you went to a straight liquidation, you know, under the Uniform Commercial Code or otherwise with these secured creditors, it really would be a waste, and you know, just a tremendous amount of value would be lost. Now, that's not to say that bankruptcy is perfect. It isn't. This complex bankruptcy code that we have is a result in part of a lot of interest groups and others who have wanted specific provisions, and so, you know, not everybody's treated the same in, under the bankruptcy code, but, you know, that's Congress's design.
Is there any future plans for changing the bankruptcy code again or adding to it?
Well, there are always people who want their own amendments. You know, the only thing that I have heard recently is this concept of a new chapter for someone that's too big to fail. That's really the only substantive change that I'm following. And, you know, that could be interesting to see how, you know, that was defined, what companies would fall within that. Would it only be Lehman Brothers and AIG or, you know, and General Motors, or, you know, would it be broader than that? That's always an interesting debate, and, you know, we'll see if that goes anywhere.
Well, you know, certainly with all the different practice areas in law, and we know there are many, many out there, why did you pick bankruptcy practice for yourself?
Well, you know, when I was in law school, I took bankruptcy, and, you know, I found it interesting, but, you know, I still didn't really know what I wanted to focus on as a career, but I started working on bankruptcy cases shortly after I graduated, and the one thing that became quickly apparent is in bankruptcy law, you get a little bit of everything. You learn litigation, you appear in court on a regular basis, and there are the federal rules of civil procedure and the federal rules of bankruptcy procedure, so in a sense, you're a litigator, but bankruptcy is also deal-based, so you learn transactions, and, you know, when you're learning, you learn a little bit about each company you represent, so you learn a lot of businesses. So I guess the way I put it is, you know, what I enjoy about bankruptcy is you sort of get a little bit of everything. And
certainly, you know, no cases are alike, right?
That's right. You know, no two cases are alike. And each case, you learn something new, whether it's about the business or, you know, about a special provision of the bankruptcy code. I remember in one case I learned about PACA. And, you know, that's not in the bankruptcy code, but under the bankruptcy rules, those type of claims for perishable items have a priority over even the claims of secured lenders in some cases. So, you know, you learn something in each case, and that's why it interests me, and I think it's what I'll continue to focus on.
That's great. You know, it always amazes me how fast an hour goes on Franchise Today. Dylan, thank you for being my guest today. I'm sure our listeners learned enough today that franchise bankruptcy has been demystified in their minds, at least has put them a step closer and on the right track.
Yeah, I'm sure everybody's crystal clear, right?
I'm sure not, which is the reason why we have individuals and professionals like you out there in the legal world. Thanks again for being my guest today.
Thank you.
Again, I'd like to thank Franchise Today co-producer Joe Caruso for putting together another informative segment of Franchise Today. Next week and for most of August, I'll be hosting Franchise Today on the road as I visit with franchisors and franchisees in 16 cities east of the Mississippi. At least that was the last count. Anyway, I promise we won't miss a beat. Until next week, I'm Paul Segretto wishing you continued success in this great thing we call franchising. Have a great day and be safe.